You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
March can be won, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done, singly done. And by union, what we will can be accomplished still. Drops of water turn a mill, singly done, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any union.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by the Greater Kansas City AFL-CIO and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 124. The Greater Kansas City AFL-CIO is the federation of 57 unions on the Missouri side of the Kansas City metro area, representing 12 million working people in all walks of life. It advocates for them with elected officials at City Hall, with employers, and the media. And the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers supports the Heartland Labor Forum. We've been wiring Kansas City since 1905. If you're not finding your electrical contractor at IBEWLocal124.org, then you're not getting the best value for your money. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, opponents of Medicare for All say it would be inferior to union-negotiated health care plans. This week on the show, we're going to find out if Medicare for All is actually a Cadillac health care plan, better even than health care plans enjoyed by the highest paid union workers. Then, we're going to talk to labor lawyer Mark Galis about how Trump's NLRB is eroding our rights to organize and bargain. In the news, did Richard Trumka really say that to the NLRB general director? And so, why has the U.S. been exporting ventilators and other medical equipment for the last 2 months? Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Aereo. She'll talk about how to work safe in the age of coronavirus. Now for the news. Now for the news from our side, April 2nd, 2020. The Trump administration is losing no time in using the distraction of the sweeping pandemic to implement long-desired plans, which most people oppose. Just this week, they've not only announced a rollback during the pandemic of all environmental regulations, a total gift to their dirty corporate supporters, but they've also sent warships into the Caribbean to threaten war against beleaguered Venezuela on a bogus drug hunt. Gaining little notice is what they're doing to labor law, the subject on the second half of tonight's show, but also just this week, the National Labor Relations Board announced changes to workers' rights to fair union elections and to pick their representatives that were so bad that AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka blasted a reaction to NLRB Chairman John Ring. Trumka said, quote, "I write to express my utter outrage, indeed incredulity, that the National Labor Relations Board, while itself delaying all elections and hearings nationwide, chose a moment of national emergency to divert its resources in order to make it more difficult for employees to obtain representation during this public health and economic crisis. While America's workers are risking our lives to keep you safe and fed, you and your colleagues have chosen this moment to change the rules under which we can gain the representation we need to protect ourselves. This was unthinking at best and surely the product of an ideological zeal that has marked your tenure as chairman and that at present makes you oblivious to the reality that exists in the workplace as I write this letter." Trumka's letter must have stung, since after receiving it, Ring lifted the suspension on union representation elections. He did not, however, rescind the rules that make winning a union even harder than before.
Nurses and doctors all over the country are fighting for better protective gear, gowns, masks, etc., plus more hospital beds, ventilators, etc., etc. The lack of preparedness to this country costs more lives every day. While U.S. wasn't preparing, other countries were, and our companies were helping. According to Lee Fang of The Interceptor, vessels manifest maintained by U.S. Customs and Border Protection and reviewed by The Interceptor showed a steady flow of medical equipment needed to treat the coronavirus being shipped abroad as recently as March 17th. Drive DeBlavis Healthcare, a Pennsylvania-based health product firm that produces supplemental oxygen machines, sent at least three different shipments of respiratory equipment to Belgium in mid-February and early March. The total cargo included 14 containers weighing more than 55 tons. In response to demand, they added 50 workers and the second shift on March 8. 2 tons of Vapotherm's high-flow disposable patient circuit units used for operating its respiratory aids were loaded into container ships in the port of Los Angeles. The shipment was sent to Kobe, Japan, for Japanese Medical Next Company, a healthcare distributor. The records show dozens of other shipments of respiratory equipment, medical garments, medical masks, oxygen concentrators, and ventilators sent abroad over the last 2 months. Finally, a St. Louis company, Allied Healthcare Products, shipped 1.5 tons of masks to Germany on February 28. In fact, Global Trade Alert reported that from January 1st through March 11, 24 countries, including South Korea, Germany, moved to ban exports of vital healthcare products in a bid to shore up domestic supply. On the other hand, the U.S. government has placed no restrictions on exports of medical supplies while continuing to impose financial penalties on the import of personal protective gear, protective goggles, pulse oximeters, hand sanitation, and other medical products from China. On March 10th and 12th, President Donald Trump temporarily lifted tariffs in place since 2017 on some of the medical products. Some advocates, not that we ban exports, but medical equipment and supplies, but that we were given U.S., the state governments, the right to first refuse to buy them.
The issue of paid sick leave is becoming huge across the country. Judd Legum writes for Popular Information. He has exposed that Amazon has one of the stingiest policies on sick leave. A significant number of Amazon workforce, particularly part-time employees and contract workers, are not receiving paid sick time. In response to the pandemic, Amazon said it would provide 2 weeks of sick leave to all Amazon employees diagnosed with COVID-19 or placed into quarantine. Of course, that means the worker would have to get a test. Kroger had a similar policy until Saturday when, after a Legum expose, Kroger expanded its policy to cover workers with COVID-19 symptoms or who need to care for sick family members. This occurred after Kroger first offered its employees a $25 food coupon as hazard pay, then accused Legum of being divisive. Finally, after competing chain Publix gave its workers paid sick leave, Kroger gave in. Amazon, however, has held firm. Amazon's large contract workforce, which delivers packages and performs other critical tasks, is in even worse shape. They get no sick leave, even if they test positive for COVID-19. Instead, these workers must apply to the Amazon Relief Fund and apply for a grant to cover their sick leave. The fund characterizes itself as focused on supporting our U.S.-based delivery associates employed by delivery service providers, our Amazon Flex delivery partners, and associates working for Integrity Staffing, Attico Staffing, and Rest Staffing, and drivers and support team members of line haul partners under financial distress due to COVID-19 diagnosis or quarantine.
Amazon donated $25 million to the fund and is soliciting individual donations to add to the pot. It initially included an option to donate by text. So, Amazon shoppers, rather than donating to the Amazon Relief Fund to salve your conscience, think about just shopping elsewhere.
Finally, we are sharing a correction from the League of Women Voters report from our tax incentives financial study on last week's Heartland Labor Forum, when one of our guests mischaracterized the worker of a EDC, or Economic Development Corporation. In fact, the EDC does have a small business loan program. Small business persons can come to the EDC and ask for a loan to open a restaurant. On the EDC website, you can read Loan Corporation's success stories. The League study was narrowly focused on property taxes and did not cover all of the many twos that were overseen by the EDC. All of the many financial twos used by the EDC can be reviewed on their website.
And that's the news from our side. The news tonight was read by Michael Savoir, and I'm Judy Ansel. Mm-hmm.
Good evening, and welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Michael Savoie. The title of our show tonight is Medicare for All is the Real Cadillac of Union Healthcare. That music you just heard was Ann Feeney. We want national healthcare now, and we certainly do. My guest tonight is Dr. Ed Weisberg. He is the chair of the Missouri chapter of Physicians National Health Program. Good evening, Ed. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Well, thanks, Michael. I appreciate you having me on.
Again, welcome, and we're certainly appreciative of you taking a little time to be on our show tonight. I think you have so much to offer to our listening audience.
Thanks for having me. It's an important topic.
Indeed. Ed, when we first talked about planning this show, we wanted to debunk the myth that union health care, the Cadillac plans, are much better than Medicare for All. And of course, it doesn't take a planet-wide catastrophe for us to see the essential in operation of our healthcare system. So why don't you tell our listeners, Ed, what exactly Physicians for National Healthcare Program, what are they and what do we do?
Sure. Yeah, well, we're a national nonprofit, completely volunteer. I'm a volunteer. We're funded only from ourselves, and we're laser focused for decades now on the idea that every person in our country should be able to get health care, top quality health care, and not have to go bankrupt to pay for it. In fact, we believe that it's a wise move for the country to make health care free and widely available and have patients able to pick their own doctor, their own hospital, put people in control of it. You can go anywhere you want for this, and it turns out we can actually save money by doing it that way. And there's very few people in our country today who have anything like the kind of health insurance policy that improved Medicare would create. And we all need that. If we don't know that now, my gosh, we'll never learn it. So,
you know, Ed, I'd called around a little bit trying to find a union health care advocate and didn't get any return calls back, although probably could have asked Joe Biden. Joe announced this week that he supports, or he's opposition to health care for all. So could you tell us a little bit about what Medicare for All is then? Is that, you know, there's so many terms out there, the single payer, the Obamacare. For our listeners, tell us what Medicare for All would look like.
Yeah, Medicare for All is a real simple concept. It just says take Medicare, improve the few things we know are wrong about Medicare, so improve it, and then give that to everybody. You know, get rid of the copays, get rid of the deductibles, get rid of the premiums. But, you know, with Medicare, you can go to almost any doctor in the country, anywhere that you are. You know, you can be taking vacation, you know, halfway across the country when things get better. And if you get sick and need to go to a doctor in Alabama or in Alaska, you can do that with Medicare. You can't do that with most other insurance plans. So with Medicare, it's real simple. You just improve the few things that are wrong with it and give that to everyone in the country. And then it doesn't matter what job status is. You know, if you decide you need to go out on strike, or if your employer lays you off, or something happens and you're not working at that company for whatever reason, you don't have to worry that means you no longer have health insurance. You know, we saw that happen over and over again, and it's happening now. So
just this week,
a real simple concept. If you live in the United States, if you're a resident here, we don't want people going without health care. We want everybody to be able to get health care when they need it in exactly the way they think they want it. And the really silly thing is that preventing people from that is more expensive than giving that to people. So the country would save money. We would no longer have to go bankrupt when we get sick. We'd control our own choices. Every individual person could pick any doctor in the country, not have to check any lists, not have to see what's in network. You wouldn't have to worry, is this procedure covered? If it's a medically necessary thing, it's going to be included in the benefit design. So,
you know, Ed,
nobody's going to whittle away at it.
We've been fighting this battle, I say we, but working class people have since the Roosevelt era. I think it was originally proposed at the same time Social Security was, and the powers that be, whoever they are, has certainly been denying us that, even though I think numbers like 95% of Americans are in favor of Medicare for All. It's high.
I don't think it's not quite that high, but it's a strong majority.
Yeah.
And actually in both parties, and actually the pandemic is making that number shoot up. So people are realizing that they can't rely on having health care be linked to their jobs. You know, anything can happen to an employer. Anything can happen to a job for lots of reasons. And having your health care linked to that, you know, Just 2 months ago, people were fighting and saying, you know, don't mess with my health care. I want it through my employer. And, you know, now all of a sudden people are realizing that they can't rely on that. Now they're saying, well, why isn't the federal government doing something? Why doesn't the federal government give us Medicare, give us health insurance? That's what we're saying. You shouldn't have to worry that when the country goes into a catastrophe like we're all in the middle of right now, you shouldn't have to worry that means you might lose your job, and that would mean that you might not have health insurance. That should not be on the table. No other country around the world, everybody's dealing with this pandemic right now, and we're the only industrialized nation where people have to layer on top of that, now what do I do? I'm not going to have insurance. Now what do I do? You know, we've got enough stuff to worry about right now. You shouldn't have to worry that going to get your COVID test, going to get your coronavirus test, you know, or if, God forbid, you're positive and you get sick and you wind up in the hospital and, you know, spend a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks on a ventilator, and how much is that going to cost? It's going to bankrupt people when they get out of the hospital if they're lucky enough to get out. You shouldn't have to worry about that. There's enough to worry about right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for crying out loud, let's get healthcare away from employment. Let's get healthcare off the table, and let's make sure everybody in our country has the peace of mind that we need to know that that's a guaranteed birthright.
Well,
you're in this country, you get healthcare. You don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, well, they've certainly perpetuated that myth as if it were the gospel there, man, that we've got better union health plans and we don't want that, and it's created a division right down the middle of labor there. I dare say it's all perpetuated by the insurance companies, but that's just my opinion.
Yeah, you know, it's crazy to distract unions from the stuff that they have to do. You know, we need unions able to negotiate wages and working conditions and other things like that. But by having this skyrocketing cost of health care be the first thing every year at the negotiating table, You know what they have to do. They have to negotiate for health care benefits because, you know, without health insurance, people are, you know, risking dying or risking bankruptcy. So they have to prioritize that. But that's going up. That's so uncontrolled an expense that wages suffer as a result, and all the other good things that labor brings to the country and certainly to its members, that gets put on the back burner. So we need to free labor up to work on the things that only labor can work on and get back to what they do and get health care for the whole country and forget about this problem.
Yeah, Ed, I'd say it's a no-brainer, but at the same time, the tremendous cost that could be realized by having a single-payer health care is just, astronomical. Figures at hand?
The cost of doing Medicare for all is a big number.
The savings.
But the cost of not doing Medicare for all is a bigger number.
That's what I'm saying. See, so we would save a lot of money.
We would save a lot of money.
Absolutely. Yeah,
the worst case is we would break even. That's the worst, is that we would break even as a country. But most studies say we would save a lot of money. And, what that means is that you can have more wages, And actually, that's part of what the plan is when we do finally get to Medicare for all, is that that means that employers would be required to renegotiate contracts to make sure that they don't just, the savings that employers get by going to Medicare for all, they shouldn't just get to keep that. That needs to go back into wages or whatever other benefits unions decide they prefer.
Absolutely.
So that's got to come back to labor.
Cost of pharmaceuticals as well would certainly come down with a single payer. And one that focuses on offering a service to its members, not a profit from its members. And we see that everywhere we look. So I think we're long overdue for some serious change there in our healthcare system. And certainly I can appreciate what your group is doing there. And before we get off the phone, Ed, I want you to tell us a little bit about what PNHPs, that is Physicians for National Health Program, is their outreach and how you're reaching out to the community. I was rather impressed looking at your newsletters and your website of all the work you guys do.
Well, thanks. Yeah. All of your listeners should go right now to showmemedicareforall.org, showmemedicareforall.org, and you can see what we're up to, see what we're about. You can sign up for the emails that we send out, and you can certainly join. You don't need to be a physician. We call ourselves Physicians for a National Health Program, but we have a significant number of our members around the country who are not physicians, and we just focus on that. We just focus on making sure that everybody in the country has access to health care, and we think the best way to do that is through improving and expanding Medicare to everybody in the country.
Mm-hmm. Well,
ShowMeMedicareForAll.org.
Yeah, I know it's been certainly been batted around a lot, and there's some confusion about, as I said a little bit earlier, the Obama plan, the so-called ACA, I think it was, kind of forgot the acronym, and then of course single payer seems to have a different following, and there's some confusion around it there. So I'm thinking. Best for all of us would be just one plan for everyone.
Yeah, you shouldn't have to learn what a deductible is or a copay. You shouldn't have to learn what a supplemental Medicare policy. You shouldn't have to learn any of that stuff. No other country makes their people go through that, So we should fix this. The ACA brought a lot of good things, but it didn't go nearly far enough. I'm glad we have it, but it's time to go further. The ACA doesn't protect people from a pandemic. It doesn't give you that peace of mind. The ACA still has you linked to your employer many times. Mm-hmm. So we need to fix that.
Yeah. So tell me, Ed, what do you think will be the outcome of the layoffs that we're going to experience across America? Like I said, there were 6 million just this week filed for unemployment, and I would imagine that number will continue to grow.
Well, I think it's somewhat up to us, me, you, your listeners, and the whole country to decide what's going to come of this. Some countries, when they go through tough times like this, become, really ugly, become authoritarian. But other countries and other times in history, a crisis like this really unites people and brings them together and has them realize, guess what? We actually are all in this together. When my brother suffers, when my neighbor suffers, when my community's not doing well, that's me. That's me personally. And I'm hopeful that conversations like this and many others that are happening, I'm hopeful that's going to help our country make that second choice, that we don't go into a dark time, but instead we realize that we are in this together. Let's start acting like it. Let's start looking out for our family, for our brothers, our sisters, our neighbors, our friends, our community, and the whole country. And I'm hopeful that that's how we're going to go. And I have reason to believe that that is how it's going to go. The surveys show that in the last month, the popularity of Medicare for All is beginning to skyrocket. So that, to me, is just one indicator that people are going to come together. We're going to go back to sort of the American tradition of looking out for each other, which is, you know, frankly, a lot of that's been led by the labor movement. And so I see this as a great opportunity for unions to lead the country again.
Well, absolutely, Ed. We'd like to see that happen as well. You know, there's so many people going to be out of insurance coverage. It's going to force, in my opinion, that Congress has to take some serious looks at maintaining this system we got for profit health care that is just not serving anyone, you see, except,
right.
except the fat cats. So I'm in high hopes that that message can come out of it. And the fact that we're sitting at home now with time to think about these things, why, perhaps it'll give us a better opportunity as well to be firm in our support of what's best for all of America. You see?
That's right.
Indeed. So listen, I certainly want to thank you for being a guest tonight on the Heartland Labor Forum. I think you've helped to dispel some of the rumors perpetuated by insurance companies that labor should be divided about health care and should be opposed to Medicare for All because the quality is different, and that's just not so at all. So, Ed, thanks for being with us tonight. And
well, thank you, Michael.
Mm-hmm. Bye now.
And your listeners should go to showmemedicareforall.org.
Thank you.
Support for KKFI comes from the Climate Council of Greater KC, providing the online Climate University April 18th. Learn more about registrations at climategkc.org. Offering a variety of presentations and workshops to help us understand the steps to reverse global warming. Information on the KC Climate Action Plan, sustainable food, and much more. This event is April 18th online. To learn more about registrations, climategkc.org. Support for KKFI comes from the Climate Council of Greater KC, presenting the 2020 Earth Festival, April 16th through the 26th. This year is the 50th anniversary of the very first Earth Day and continues on with over 30 events online at climategkc.org. Speakers forums and a climate university on sustainable living from energy and mobility to food and fashion. Learn more or register for the April 16th to 26th events at climategkc.org.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel. We are all inundated by news of the virus. Let's take a break for some other bad news. For months now, the news from our side has been reporting one assault after another on our labor rights by the Trump appointees on the National Labor Relations Board, or NLRB. Tonight, we're going to get an overview of what's been going on. But first, if you need a refresher on who the NLRB is, here it is. Back during the Depression, which we hope we're not about to repeat, Congress passed the National Labor Relations Act, which gave most workers in the private sector the right to organize and make demands on their employers collectively and to bargain with their employers, and if they didn't get what they wanted, to strike. All of these actions became what's called protected activities. In other words, you couldn't be fired for them. In charge of enforcing our rights, the law established the National Labor Relations Board. The president appoints its members, and three are supposed to be from his party and two from the other. Currently, the board only has four members, three Republicans and one Democrat, because Trump hasn't appointed a fifth member. They serve for 5 years, one leaves each year. That the majority currently on the board are doing their best to completely neuter the National Labor Relations Act is hardly a controversial statement. We thought tonight we'd take stock and assess how much damage they've done so far. With us to do that is Mark Gallis. Mark is a union-side labor lawyer with the Bucati, Aubrey, and Huntsman firm in Overland Park. The firm represents both private and public sector unions and their members. Mark has practiced law for more than 20 years, focusing on labor and employment issues. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Hi, Judy.
Let's explain a little more about the law. What does the NLRA make illegal as far as employer conduct toward workers and unions?
Well, the National Labor Relations Act is designed to protect an employee and workers to engage in concerted activities for the benefit of themselves. And that's been a public policy now since the 1930s, since the New Deal. And it prohibits various unfair labor practices on the part of employers.
We can't cover all of the damage that's being done right now by the Trump administration, but I thought we'd start with how the NLRB is trying to make new rules and set them in stone so that the next administration will have a hard time undoing them. Can you explain what the rulemaking part is?
Sure. As a little bit of a preface, the board sets policy really in two ways. One is by deciding cases, and the other is by rulemaking. With respect to case adjudication, you can consider the board to be sort of an administrative appeals court for labor relations issues. Issues are decided case by case, and that's a traditional method because it's preferred because it allows actual controversies to be adjudicated over time. The other way they make policy is through rulemaking, and normally the board would propose a rule, there would be a period of public comment, and then once public comments are received, a final rule is promulgated. Now, interestingly, prior to this current board, the rulemaking process has been used very sparingly. In the past 30 years or so, I think only a couple of rules have actually become final through this process. It does seem, though, that President Trump is hell-bent on undoing anything President Obama did. That's why this current board has engaged in extensive rulemaking. Back in May of 2019, they put out a unified agenda for rulemaking, which set forth various specific issues that they would focus on in order to make additional rules.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of the things that they have done. I want to ask you about who gets covered by the law, because under the Obama administration, one of the big victories for workers was the what was called the joint employer standard, mm-hmm. where, for instance, if you work for a franchisee of McDonald's or some other fast food company, you could actually bring charges against a McDonald's or the parent as well. And that's one example, I think, of how they're changing. Can you explain that?
Well, that's one of the first rules that was issued, the joint employer rule. The old rule was an analysis of a common law employment test as to whether you are a joint employer or not. And there had to be a showing of sufficient control for there to be considered a joint employment relationship. I think that was from 2015 during the Obama administration. The new rule says that there has to be substantial, direct, and immediate control over the terms and conditions. And so that's going to make it much more difficult to prove joint employer status. So that was one of the first rules that the board put forth, because that was one of the main priorities, to get rid of joint employer status and make it more difficult for, as you explained, the McDonald's situation or temp agencies, those kind of things, mm-hmm. make it more difficult for unions to take hold in those industries.
Okay. There's also been some rules, haven't there, about contractors and people, even people who are misclassified as contractors but should be employees?
There was some discussion of rulemaking on some of those issues. I know that there have been cases decided specifically on the issue you're talking about. There were a couple of cases decided in the last, year and a half, where employers can now more easily classify workers as independent contractors. And in fact, they went further than that to say that if the employer misclassifies a worker, it's not an unfair labor practice, which is remarkable. And the reason it's important, I should point out, is that the National Labor Relations Act covers employees. It does not protect independent contractors. So naturally, if you have more of your workforce as independent contractors, they're not covered by the Act. And therefore, again, unions can't come in and engage in concerted activities to help the benefit of all the workers.
Right. And we have a growing number of people like that who are classified as independent contractors. You know, for example, the ride sharing companies, the grocery delivery companies, all those people, I think, are independent contractors, right?
Yeah, the whole idea of the gig economy. In addition, one of the other priorities involved what are called R case procedures. The board has two types of cases. There are C cases, which are unfair labor practices, and there are R cases, which are certification or decertification of a union being the exclusive bargaining representative. Back in 2014, the Obama board streamlined this process to make it easier for elections to occur. The new rule that was promulgated by the board in the last year was they added about a dozen changes, which extends deadlines and adds steps to make the process more difficult. The employer community thought that the old rule was election by ambush, and so that carried the day. And interestingly, on this issue, there was no comment period, and the reason is because the board they view their inherent authority to change the election process. And so it was not subjected to the normal rulemaking process that many of these others were subjected to.
So did any labor lawyers challenge that they didn't have a comment period?
I think most of these that are passed are going to be challenged in some fashion. The AFL-CIO is usually very aggressive in taking these to court, to challenging the rules and the challenging the whether it was arbitrary and capricious or whether the board had the right to do that. But that certainly raised some eyebrows. Just this week, just a couple of days ago, the board put forth a few new rules.
Yeah,
as
I was
well.
Going to ask you about those, yeah.
And what I find interesting is that it's always spun as dealing with employee choice. But we're here to protect the workers' choice, which is somewhat laughable. What they're really doing is they're helping employers drive away unions. I mean,
they do it in the name of individual rights, right? You have an individual right as opposed to, you know, any kind of ability to collectively make a decision. And it the whole gist of it is that it undermines any power of the group, right?
That's right. And you can even look back to, I view labor relations as sort of a pendulum. Prior to the National Labor Relations Act, workers had no rights. And the pendulum was fully swung to the employer side. Well, National Labor Relations Act, the Wagner Act, is passed. The pendulum starts swinging back toward employee rights. And then in the late 40s, the Taft-Hartley Act came about, which said, not only does an employee have the right to join a union, but Taft-Hartley said, the employee has a right to not join a union. And so Taft-Hartley is still, those are two dirty words in the labor community. But the rulemaking this week, like I said, just 2 days ago, and you have to think of it in the context of 2 weeks ago, the board essentially suspended all elections and all hearings. So as of 2 days ago, there was no opportunity for any sort of election, whether it be in person, by mail, whatever.
And this is because of the virus, right?
Because of COVID-19, that's right. So the rulemaking that came down a couple days ago, one involves what's called blocking. So under the old rule, if there were serious unfair labor practices that would render a fair election impossible, that would block an election until the unlawful conduct was remedied. Makes sense. The employer is engaging in all this unfair conduct. The election is stopped, you figure it out, and then you go forward. The new rule says that if the unfair labor practice charge is filed, the election is still conducted, but the board will impound the ballots for up to 60 days.
Right.
The employers had argued that the unions were filing frivolous unfair labor practice charges in order to halt decertification elections. They were accusing the unions of, filing these charges and then rushing to the people and to the workers and saying, keep the union, keep the union. So again, the employer lobby, the Chamber of Commerce is a major actor in this. That again carried the day. There's something called the voluntary recognition bar. There are two ways that a union can be recognized as the exclusive bargaining representative.
And that's in the law, right?
Yeah, there's two ways. One is you have a show of interest, you have an election, the union is elected. The other is the union goes to an employer and says, look, I have a show of interest from 51%, 75%, 95%, and will you voluntarily recognize the union? And that is statutory. The old rule said that you had 6 months, you had to wait at least 6 months before disaffected workers could file a decertification position. And the idea was you want to give sufficient time for labor and management to meet to work out the terms of a collective bargaining agreement. Mm-hmm. The new rule says you have a 45-day window after the recognition to file your decertification position, this petition. So the idea here is that as soon as there is the voluntary recognition, those disaffected folks can immediately act. And this rule, some of these rules were, Obama creations, you know, that came about more so during the Obama administration. This old rule was in effect from at least the mid-60s until the Bush 43 administration, and then, from 2011 to the present. So this is not whole cloth, the old rule. And the other one had to do with pre-hire agreements in the construction industry. The construction industry is a little bit different when it comes to these pre-hire agreements. Construction workers engage in, short-term or sporadic employment, and unions are a good source for trained or skilled workers. And so to preserve the right to organize, you can engage in or enter into these pre-hire agreements. The union doesn't actually have to show that it has majority support initially. But the key thing is, when you have a pre-hire agreement, when can you convert it to an actual collective bargaining agreement? Well, in the old rule, it was sufficient for the contract itself to say, we have majority support of the employees. But under the new rule, you have to show positive evidence. You have to show those cards, or you have to show.
So wait, well, let me stop you. So you're talking about a construction site.
This
where
is peculiar only to the construction industry.
Yeah, okay. So say, let's take the airport. Okay, say they're going to hire electricians, mm-hmm. and they don't previously have an agreement, I guess. So does that mean that all the electricians that they hire will have to vote? Is that how that works?
Well, it has to. They're going to have to show that there's support for the union to come in there. Now, under the new rule, you have to show positive evidence of it. Meaning,
does this mean on every job, or does it? How does that work?
It could mean per every job. I mean, that's a possibility. It's making it more difficult for unions to come into these positions, and it allows employers to find non-unionized work, and it creates.
If they do the hiring, they could selectively hire a group of people who are anti-union, right?
Sure, and it's now easier to do so. The new rules this week were, as I mentioned, particularly egregious because of the suspension of the elections. The AFL-CIO expressed its disapproval and outrage rather quickly. My understanding is that Richard Trumka, the president of the AFL-CIO, sent a nastygram to chairman of the NLRB expressing his outrage. And it must have had some effect because yesterday the board announced that elections will resume next week.
Oh my!
That the regional directors, the country split up into various regions, and there's a regional director in charge of each region, and the regional directors are going to have the discretion to decide whether elections will be manual or whether they'll be mail. My guess is that most elections for the foreseeable future are going to be by mail ballot only, in order to keep, people, instead of calling everyone into the union hall and to vote, mail ballots are probably going to rule the day, at least for a little while.
Interesting. Okay, well, we only have a couple of minutes left. But, given the fact that workers who are still working are working under a tremendous amount of stress and facing challenges that they don't normally face, we're seeing a lot of discontent. I mean, we saw just this week, strikes by
various workers, including Amazon workers, short strikes. So I expect there's going to be a little bit of an upsurge in organizing. So what you're saying is that it's possible for workers to organize now, right?
It is possible. It is possible. And, you know, what history has shown is that workers acting collectively has created tremendous benefits in terms of the terms and conditions of their employment.
It could even save your life.
It could. And there are a number of industries that I think are under-organized who think, well, we can't. They think of unions as being the UAW or the sheet metal workers. They think of heavy industry as opposed to service workers or office workers. And I think those are the areas that you'll see organized more in the near future. You know, as far as the board goes, what we're advising clients is if you have something that's going on, stay away from the board. Take it to arbitration under your collective bargaining.
Which is ironic because we've been avoiding arbitration for a long time and wanting the board to decide things, right?
I'll quickly note that there are at least a dozen cases decided which are really anti-union. And the only one that's been decided in the last year and a half that has any positive effect for unions is a decision where having to do with deferral, the issue we're just talking about. It makes it easier for unfair labor practices to be heard by an arbitrator under the grievance procedure. You know, for years it was very difficult to defer to an arbitrator, but now the rules are much easier, which employers have taken as a win, but, you know, secretly or quietly, it's actually a win for unions at this point because we're telling our folks, don't go to the board unless it's absolutely necessary. If you have an unfair labor practice, if it's a violation of the contract, take it to arbitration, have an arbitrator hear it, and now it's easier to defer to that arbitrator in a decision.
Well, yeah, except in the big picture, of course, it's a sign of how dysfunctional our labor law has become and how the great law, the National Labor Relations Act, which we won in the 1930s, has been so completely undermined that we can't depend on it and we have to look for other ways.
It's been watered down over time, especially through Taft-Hartley. When you have a board like the Obama board was very proactive when it came to employees' rights, workers' rights, union rights. And you know, I should note that when a new administration comes in, there's always some rollback. That's not uncommon. But the fervor of the Trump board to reverse employee and union gains has been rather startling.
Well, we're going to leave it at that. Thank you so much, Mark Gallus, for being on the Heartland Labor Forum. Mark Gallus is an attorney, a union side attorney with the Bucati, Aubrey, and Huntsman firm. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Mary Aereo for Safety First. The pandemic has dominated the news. First recommended COVID-19 response plan for construction employers from www.lhsfna.org for March 20th. The Laborers Health and Safety Fund of North America, LHSFNA, recognizes that LIUNA signatory employers are committed to ensuring the safety and health of their workforce, including taking the appropriate steps to limit the spread of the novel coronavirus and the disease it causes, COVID-19. The current information suggests COVID-19 is spread through close personal contact, such as touching or shaking hands, followed by touching the mouth, nose, or eyes, airborne respiratory droplets expelled during regular talking and breathing, as well as coughing and sneezing, and touching a contaminated surface or object, then touching the mouth, nose, or eyes. Enclosed spaces, such as trailers or toilets, confined spaces, and any space with recycled air presents additional exposure risks and should be avoided as much as possible. Construction employers should perform a risk assessment of the job site, educate and train workers, reinforce good hygiene practices and take steps to make it easy for workers to frequently wash their hands, institute policies and practices that maintain physical distance, identify, clean, and sanitize high-risk transmission areas regularly, provide appropriate personal protective equipment, and require sick workers to stay home. Read the entire publication at www.lhsfna.org. Next, legislation would direct OSHA to issue emergency standard for healthcare facilities from www.safetyandhealthmagazine.com for March 11th. In response to the COVID-19 pandemic, House Education and Labor Committee Chair Representative Bobby Scott, Democrat of Virginia, and 20 other representatives are sponsoring a partisan bill that would require OSHA to issue an emergency temporary standard for healthcare facilities to implement comprehensive infectious disease exposure control plans. The COVID-19 Healthcare Worker Protection Act of 2020, H.R. 6139, would direct OSHA to publish the temporary standard within 30 days. On March 5th, Scott and Representative Alma Adams, Democrat of North Carolina, chair of the House Workforce Protection Subcommittee, sent a letter to Secretary of Labor Eugene Scalia and Acting OSHA Administrator Lauren Sweet. If healthcare workers are quarantined in large numbers or get ill or die or fear coming to work due to the risks, it's not just a personal or workplace problem. It's a national public health disaster, the letter states. National Nurses United, the nation's largest union and professional association of direct care registered nurses, also petitioned OSHA. OSHA published employer guidance on the coronavirus on March 19th at www.osha.gov. For more information about the bill and to contact your representative, go to actionnetwork.org/forms, F-O-R-M-S, /HR6139. Last but not least, EPA ends enforcement during novel coronavirus outbreak. From www.ehstoday.com/environment for March 7th. Companies encountering civil violations during the COVID-19 outbreak should not expect penalties for noncompliance, according to new temporary guidance from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. The agency is suspending its enforcement policies for civil violations indefinitely, citing lack of access to key staff, laboratories, and facilities that work to analyze samples due to the current social distancing measures and travel restrictions, but does expect operators of public water systems to continue to ensure safety of our drinking water. In order to be eligible, the facility needs to keep records and document any procedures or steps made to prevent or mitigate noncompliance and demonstrate how the pandemic contributed to the noncompliance. Opponents of the measure spoke out against the sweeping suspension of pollution policies as a response to the pandemic. Thomas Opel, Executive Vice President, American Sustainable Business Council, told the media, the EPA decision exploits a public health crisis to further advance a dangerous political agenda. Wisconsin 2nd District Representative Mark Pocan tweeted, outrageous, suspending all environmental regulations indefinitely? This has nothing to do with coronavirus. This has everything to do with protecting big business. Be careful out there. This is Mary Ario for Safety First.
And this is Judy Ansel with the Heartland Labor Forum calendar, which again is quite short. Missouri Jobs with Justice is going to be having a webinar on expanding voting rights in Missouri. And that's going to be Tuesday, April 7th. They're doing it two times. One is at 2 p.m. and the other is at 6 p.m. And that's on your computer. And in order to sign up, go to the Missouri Jobs with Justice Facebook page. And they haven't canceled the Midwest School for Women Workers yet. It's scheduled to be June 22nd to 26th in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois. We'll keep you posted, but if you want more information, you can look up Midwest School for Women Workers at the University of Illinois, Champaign. And an announcement from the Missouri Department of Labor and Industrial Relations, Division of Employment Security. They reported today that a total of 104,230 initial claims for the week ending March 28th for unemployment were filed. It's an increase of nearly 147% over the previous week. And they're asking people to file for unemployment online because even though they're adding staff and just about everybody in the state's Department of Labor and Industrial Relations is moving over to deal with unemployment claims. They're still flooded with phone calls. And if you have questions about when you're going to get your money from the government stimulus, don't call. They don't know. They say that's up to the federal government, and they'll let people know when they find out. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show is going to be an interview with Pat Jones Macklin, Kansas City's labor conscience, and we're going to be talking about COVID-19 and worker rights. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Andy Erdrich, and stay tuned for the Thursday night special.
Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
The common man's rights to be in the working class is good enough for me. Sweating for an honest way. place to be, 'cause we are the working class, and that's the place to be, 'cause we are the working class, and that's the place to be.